Good morning, everyone. And as Jim said, welcome to AirVenture 15. I'm Mike Weinfurter, and the orange one down on the end, which has been jokingly called the Great Pumpkin and various other things, is a TL-19A bird dog made by Cessna back in 1952. A little bit about the airplane. Cessna went into competition with Piper, Taylor Craft, and Luscombe to hopefully win the contract for the Army's new liaison observation aircraft around the early 1949-1950. Cessna did win and produced a little over 3,400 of them over 13 years. This one was built 24th of January, 52, the first of four built that day. And she served quite well. She's never gone overseas, that I know of. Spent the first 6 to 8 years at Fort Rucker Shell Stage Field. You'll see that in the black and white photo there on the board next to it. After Fort Rucker, where it served in those colors, it was assigned to Wisconsin Army National Guard at West Bend, first Waukesha actually, then West Bend, just around Milwaukee, from right around 1958 or 60 through the end of 1971. At that time, the unit, which was, shall we say, dual-rated, had both helicopters and fixed wing, retired all the bird dogs. Most of them were sent back to the factory for rework and sent over to Vietnam as G models. This is one of three we know of that stayed stateside, was assigned to the Civil Air Patrol. This one and a sister ship, 988, stayed here, and this one went to Superior, Wisconsin. Ironically, today I met the gentleman who licensed this airplane first as a civilian airplane for CAP back in 72. His name is in its logbooks, and I got to meet Leon today. Pretty neat thing. Stayed with Civil Air Patrol in Superior until 1980, when CAP started to sell them via sealed bid sale. Two of the squadron members up there bought it. And they proceeded to put it on floats, put it on skis, and had a lot of fun with it. And they said, if I had a dollar for every chunk of moose meat I hauled out of Canada, I'd be very rich right now. Well, about the mid-80s, they decided to sell it and went to a soaring club over in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They towed gliders with it for a few years and unfortunately wrecked it. They found out it doesn't run very well when the fuel tank's contaminated with air. The airplane was damaged pretty heavily. A gentleman near Lansing bought it, rebuilt it, and when he started restoring an actual G model, put it up for sale. I've had it now, it'll be 10 years August. It's I've been its caretaker, shall we say. It's a great airplane to fly, easy to handle, relatively easy to operate, as well as relatively cost-effective to operate. It's great handling, about 172 crude speeds. It was made to get in and out of tiny little places. Book says 400 feet off the ground and over a foot, 50-foot obstacle at gross weight, down and stopped over the same 50-footer in 300 feet. Pretty impressive performance. So that's the airplane. Now a little bit about the type of mission it flew and the people it trained. I mean, the Army started using hot air balloons for observation as far back as the Civil War. Same thing during World War I, and then morphed into the reconnaissance aircraft. Word has it the reconnaissance birds would pass each other waving on the way to go a spot on the other side. Somebody didn't wave one day, somebody got mad, somebody started shooting at each other. That's how fighters were born, so to speak. So I'm told. Anyway, even in World War II, the forward artillery units were looking for some way of seeing where the targets were. That's where the L-3s, 4s, 5s, 2s, and various other liaison airplanes came into being and did a heck of a job, both in Europe and the Pacific, looking for targets to direct the artillery fire upon. In the Mediterranean theater, they used Stinson L-5s as what they called Rover Joes. They'd send them out with P-40 squadrons, and the L-5s would, again, look for the bad guys, mark the location, quite often a smoke grenade thrown out the window, and which time the P-40s would attack it. That war's over, on comes Korea. Darn, they need the same thing again. That's where the term forward air controller was created by the Air Force. The Army still used the L-4s and 5s left over from World War II in the Pacific, but they were wearing out quickly. That's when the bird dog came into being. So its first combat assignment was Korea, where it was very highly regarded during these wars, even Civil War, World War II, and on through. Bad guys learned real quick, don't shoot at the little airplane. Has lots of friends. You shoot at little airplane, he sees you, he marks your location, calls his friends. They come down and ring hell and damnation on you, trying to kill you. So that's what its job was. That's what the forward air controllers did. Bird dogs were used by the Army back in Korea. The Air Force started using AT-6 Texans, LT-6Gs they were called. Their call sign was Mosquito. They were armed with rockets. They were some of the first armed with rockets for target marking. Korea ends. Things languish through the 50s. Here comes Vietnam. Back to work for the bird dog. They literally reinvented the forward air controller once again, sending hundreds of bird dogs over there, many of which never came home. Army started with them, moved on to the O2 Skymaster for the Air Force. The Army stayed with the bird dog all the way through the end of Vietnam. The Air Force morphed from the O1 to the O2 Skymaster, and then later on the OV-10 Bronco. Now, of the 3,400 built, there's roughly 300 flying worldwide, thereabouts. They're a great airplane. They're a great way to get into warbirds. They're a combat airplane, not just a trainer. Some things notable about the bird dog, we'll pick on Vietnam. One of the few Medal of Honor winners as a pilot during that conflict was a gentleman from North Carolina named Hilliard Wilbanks. He was an Air Force forward air controller in a bird dog, and he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for saving an entire Arvin unit from an ambush. He was killed in the process. Besides firing his rockets, he emptied his sidearm as well as his M16. Then he made dummy passes at the bad guys to try and keep their heads down till the reinforcements could arrive. He was eventually shot down in the no man's land and died en route to a MASH unit. Another notable thing about the airplane, 30th of April, 1975, Saigon's falling. There's a young Vietnamese Air Force major named Bung Lee, has a wife and five children. He knows they won't survive the North Vietnamese coming into town. He loaded his family into a commandeered bird dog and took off following some helicopters. They ended up on an island, found they couldn't stay there. The helos found out there's a carrier waiting for him out in the sea. Again, no headset. He didn't have time to grab a headset to talk to anyone. Took off, followed the helicopters to the carrier. It was the Midway. He took some pieces of paper, wrote a note on them, "Please make room for me to land." Signed, Major Bung Lee, wife and five child. The third attempt to get the note to the deck, he stuffed it in his pistol belt. That hit the deck. They got it, ran it up to the skipper. Skipper gave the order to shove over $1 million worth of helicopters over the side and make room for Bung Lee to land. And he did one of the most beautiful short field landings you ever did in a bird dog on the Midway. They filmed it. They kept the airplane. It's hanging in the Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola at this time. Bung and his family settled in Florida. He's retired now. He used to be a seafood restaurant head waiter. Children have all grown up, married, college, the works. Great guy. We had him at the 50th anniversary of the bird dog. So there's a long-winded version of what it did. Hope you enjoy it. There's plenty of things to come look at. When we're done talking, come on over.
Thank you, Mike, for the
great
history lesson.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate
that. And you can head back, and I'm going to introduce another group. So before I do, we all fly these airplanes, and Danny introduced me, and I was a police officer for 30 years before I retired. And the only reason I wasn't a fireman is because I couldn't pound a nail straight. So I can't turn a wrench. I can't keep these airplanes flying. And without the next two people that are going to be coming up here, a lot of these airplanes, including on this field, would not be able to be airborne. So Sam and Sherry Tabor, please, come on up with their L4.
Good morning. I would be the Sam half. This is the Sherry half. I'll handle technical stuff, anything normal. Talk to my wife. A little brief history on our L4, second one down here, the green one. This was, as Mike alluded to, early forward air controller. It was an observation airplane. You have to understand, in World War II, they really didn't have a lot of heavy-duty progressive radio equipment. They started out the war and some of the early maneuvers before the war throwing notes back and forth, not back and forth, from the air to the ground. Sorry.
Wow.
And that's how they would communicate. Obviously, you can see the shortcomings of that. As time went on, they started fixing some radios into the aircraft for minimal communication with some of the ground units. We have the aircraft set up right now the way they would have been used later in the war with a field artillery battalion. The long whip antenna is attached to a portable radio that sits in the airplane. It's the same radio, all 25 pounds of it, that the forward air, controllers on the ground, forward observers on the ground would have used to crawl forward and feed back to the artillery information. All they basically did was install it in the aircraft. The aircraft itself is fairly lightweight. It's got a gross weight about 1,200 pounds. It's on a day like today, it's a little bit of a challenge to fly, but they flew in all sorts of weather. They flew in all sorts of weather that most civilian pilots wouldn't fly in today in order to get the job done. If you come by and see the aircraft later on, you'll see it set up the way we had it through the manuals, through World War II photographs, dealing with some of the individuals we've been lucky enough to meet, the veterans that flew them, and we tried to replicate it so they could get in there and say, this is exactly how we saw it. So we've done our best on that. We've tried to do an honor to them. I'll let Sherry describe a little bit as to how we got it, because she doesn't remember waking up in the middle of the night and saying, could we please get a Cub? And she denies that that happened, but it did. I remember it. And as far as being entry level, it flies for about 4 or 5 gallons an hour, 6 depending on which different engine is inside of there. It's a fairly light aircraft. It is an early morning flyer, an afternoon flyer. It's the sort of airplane that it has been to Dayton, Ohio, but you don't get up every day and say, hey, let's fly 300 miles in this thing. It's a close, low-range flyer, but boy, the view is, you just can't beat it. So, pass this over.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Derek.
I've been flying this plane since we got it. This is its fourth season here up at Oshkosh. We park in the liaison area right behind the reenactor tents over here, so you'd be more than welcome to come over and take a look at it, talk to us a little bit more about the plane and how it works and how easy it is to manage and take care of. I do the flying, he does the fixing. It's very economical. It flies low and slow, as Sam said. You don't go anywhere fast, but you get a really good view while you're doing it. And you probably don't want to, it took us 7 hours to get to Dayton, or back from Dayton, and it's, what, 4.5, 5 if you drive? Yeah. When the semis are passing you on the highway, you know you're going slow. We got passed by a glider twice on our way home.
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah. So it is. It's a lot of fun. It's challenging on a day like today, and flying in here, and you see as you wander around watching the runways, it's definitely challenging coming in here with all the traffic, and they just want to get the planes down and not necessarily where it's best for the airplane. So it can be very challenging even on the ground, but it's not just learning how to fly, you got to be able to maneuver it on the ground too, and that on its own is a completely different challenge. So it's a lot of fun to fly. It's a good starter. It falls into the light sport category. So if you're looking into that kind of avenue, it's a completely different way of getting your ticket. But it's a lot of fun, and if you want to see it up close and talk a little bit more, come on over to the liaison line, and we'll be more than happy to chat with you. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Sherry. And I failed to mention that Sam and Sherry also own a beautiful L5 that's parked next to their L4 whitetail, and just gorgeous. So thank you very much.